you, Mr. Baker, would like to reserve any rebuttal time, we'll be happy to do that for you.
I don't choose to.
Okay, very good, thank you.
Your Honor, I would reserve, if I might, 7 minutes or 8 minutes, 8 minutes for rebuttal.
8 minutes, okay, very good, thank you.
And I'll begin by stating that maybe the rebuttal may be as helpful to the court as my opening argument, because we're dealing with a classically complex record from the fact standpoint, but from the law standpoint, we do not believe that is quite as complex if we can get the court to focus on a couple of the primary issues from our standpoint. The first issue in the big picture is whether Mr. McDaniel is entitled to financial relief for spending money on the house that was in a state of disrepair under the party's premarital contract, which was in effect. That is, of course, the core issue, the devil's in the What we have contended, and when I say contended, I'm embarrassed in some respects by the comprehensiveness of the appendix, because there are indeed 8 post-pre and briefs and memos filed by both sides, and it speaks to the comprehensiveness and the minutia of this case. But once again, the big picture we respectfully submit is this. Was there a contract in effect? And our evidence, and we think the evidence argued by counsel as well, is not that there wasn't a premarital contract in effect. The question is, what happened at time of the resumption of the work on the house? So very briefly to walk through this sequence, just again, refresh course of recollection. The parties entered a prenuptial in December of 2008. The parties married. The parties were on the rocks by March of 2009. But in that agreement, the parties were to split the costs of the construction of the house. I'm sure you all have glanced at the language. It's relatively straightforward. We respectfully submit, and we respectfully submit it is not ambiguous. What then happens sequentially is that by March, by the appellee's testimony as well as my client's testimony, the parties, she threw Mr. McDaniel out. They got back together in the house for once or twice for a short period, and by May, she says, the parties had completely separated, May of 2009. The dates are important only because construction was continuing on the house through the gentleman, the contractor named Hilensky, I believe. We've stumbled over during trial. That construction continued primarily under the direction of the wife, Ms. Griffith, as she's known throughout the record, through September of 2009, when the record evidence establishes that she pulled the plug for reasons, marital dispute and other reasons.
Is there any evidence in the record at all that Mr. McDaniel ever authorized or ratified the decision to cease work on her?
We say no. We say, however, that Ms. Griffith blamed him for, once the work was done, blamed the contractor for not doing something properly or some dispute between her and Mr. McDaniel over something was done by the contractor, but not that he terminated the contract with number one, Lemsky. And she, in fact, said she suspended it and then just felt like because of the marriage situation she paid up, she wasn't going forward. But that was not a negotiated arrangement with McDaniel. Again, they were separated. They weren't speaking to each other, and as the record reflects over the next few months, no contact of any kind was initiated, agreed upon. There are some disputes, and the record is fuzzy as to whether there was, in fact, a protective order in effect. But essentially, there was. All communication was through counsel. Now,
counsel, let me stop you here. And if we have, obviously this is governed by contract law, and if we have a contract, and you've already acknowledged that it was not ambiguous, So if it's not ambiguous, then the trial court cannot add any additional language. And if the contract, the prenuptial agreement that contained the clause that said that they would build a house, if that was clear, then doesn't that make this case, even though there were certainly a lot of information that was provided, but doesn't that make it simple? The contract says they'll build it and they'll share in the cost equally after the husband recovers the funds from the purchase of the home. So where is your argument? Is that your argument?
My argument, if I follow the question, my argument stopped at the first hearing, and in fact a show cause hearing, as the court knows, it was a show cause hearing. The court said, well, we think if anything the remedy's in breach in contract. So we proceeded, stayed the first action, proceeded with the second action in contract, and we contend whether that was or was not the right decision, that we proceeded in contract. And so we took the position that the contract, yes, Your Honor, bound them under this deal to split the cost of the house. And we didn't. We asked the court not to take parole evidence about all the thereafter, except as to the damages.
Well, the court did take parole evidence, but wasn't it harmless altogether? Because the necessary language is contained within the contract of what needs to occur. Is that not essentially your argument?
We agree.
Okay, very, very good. So that's really your argument in a nutshell, is it not, counsel?
It is. When you're all said and done, it boils down to the contract not being ambiguous and that he's entitled to his share of the construction cost. Thank you. And then I will respond back to counsel.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Questions? Thank you, counsel.
My name is Ron Tweedle. I'm from Charlottesville, and I represent the colleague in Griffith. My counsel, co-counsel or opposing counsel says that this is a complex case and it's very technical. I don't see it that way. I don't believe it's complex. I don't believe it's technical. They would want you to retry the case and move into a shotgun approach. I'm going to move into a rifle approach and address the appropriately preserved issues and that which is right for this case. We filed a motion to dismiss. I don't know whether the court wants us to go into that because of their technical failures.
Certainly you may.
You
have 15 minutes.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. This is based under 5A, 20 C and D, where an assignment of error is not clear. If you look at their assignments of error, which are on page 5 of their opening brief, they have 3 errors. At no place do they refer to references of the transcript, of the record, of the appendix, or any place else. They therefore leave it to the court and its clerks to comb through the record, comb through the orders to find out where those things have been preserved. That is not the intent of this rule, and it's been stated by this court, I believe, that where you assign the orders, you must cite in the record there where it is. You don't require the court to go rummaging through a transcript or a record that might be inches, if not feet, thick, and they failed to do that.
We agree with you. We prefer not to do that, sir. However, we've been known to do that. So thank you for your argument.
Sometimes it's easier to find the error than with the flashlight that Judge Humphreys used in Fatness.
Okay. Their first assignment of error is that it was not ambiguous. The important point, and I'm going to be a little briefer, there is no finding of ambiguity. The final order, we have to look at what the record is. It's March 17, 2015.
Did the trial judge take parole evidence?
One question. He took one question, and It was...
Would that have been proper if he hadn't found it to be ambiguous?
I think he said that he needed to find out the intent of the parties, and that's what he said he needed to have the answer. And I think we cited that question and answer at the page, if I'd be exact here.
Well, then by definition, didn't he have to find it ambiguous?
He found that he needed to find out the intent of the parties.
Which would only be necessary if the agreement itself was ambiguous.
Yes, sir. So he, but he, the question is, did he rely upon that? And when you read his opinion letter and the order, it is clear that he did not rely upon that. So it's not properly preserved for an error that was not made.
Do you agree with counsel that the decision to cease work the first time was made by your client and that he did not authorize or ratify it?
Yes, he did.
When? Where in the record is that?
I'm sorry, I don't have the record memorized, but he was very much aware of it and was authorized to do that. It was her decision to do it. He was made aware of it, and he...
Where in the party's agreement is she authorized to unilaterally have the work on the property cease?
It's not in the agreement because the court found that one of the things that the court found was that it was a mutual agreement to jointly construct the house. In the record, I'm sorry I don't have that memorized, but it was clear from the totality of the record that he was aware of it and that he didn't object to it, because he then went out and hired Mr. Henderson 3 months later. So it's clear that he was aware of it. He didn't go back to her and say, well, you can't fire Olemsky, or I want Olemsky to continue. He was aware that he had been terminated.
Under paragraph 17B of the prenuptial agreement, did both parties have the obligation to construct the house?
Yes, sir.
When did your client's obligation to construct the house cease, and why?
The obligation to construct the house didn't cease, but his unilateral act, as stated by the trial court, to hire Mr. Henderson to do all of this work and incur all this expense was improper.
Wasn't that in response to her unilateral act of stopping what you have conceded was her obligation?
He acquiesced in that termination. And so the acquiescence of that, he was aware of it, he knew it, he went therefore and hired Mr. Henderson. He never complained to her of that termination of Mr. Olemsky. So he acquiesced in the termination, was aware of it, because if he wasn't aware of it, he wouldn't have hired Mr. Henderson. He would have just said, Mr. Olemsky, come back on the job. Where have you been for the last several months?
Well, counsel, you have acknowledged, just as counsel before you acknowledged, that the contract is not ambiguous. I thought I heard you say that you concur that the contract is not ambiguous, the premarital agreement that requires them to build the house, to build the house. And it doesn't tell us how they're to build the house or who's to build it. It just says that they're to jointly build the house. If those terms are not ambiguous, then you cannot, pursuant to case law, you can't come in and substitute information that might have been in there, should have been in there, would have been nice to be in there, because it's very clear on its face, the four corners of the document, as to what is in fact stated.
There are also some things that are clear, Your Honor, and that is the court speaks through their orders, the court speaks through their opinion letters, and nowhere in there did the court make a ruling that the agreement was ambiguous. It did say...
If we agree with you and ignore the taking of the parole evidence, then all that means is...
There's one question, Your Honor.
But if we ignore the taking of parole evidence, all that means is that the standard of review of the decision on whether his actions complied with paragraph 17B is one we review de novo, and we owe the trial court no deference, correct?
Well, I guess maybe I'm not totally comprehending, but there...
You're saying the trial court did not find the contract ambiguous?
There's no finding by the trial court that it was ambiguous.
So the contract is not ambiguous, which means
there's no finding by the trial court that it was ambiguous. Okay. That's what I'm saying.
All right. Well,
and
then
that's why they didn't.
Then it,
and it wasn't. It was not part of the court's opinion letter, nor was it a part of the court's order.
Well then
it wasn't properly.
Then the sole question in front of us, if the provision is not ambiguous and the trial court did not find it to be ambiguous, is whether the trial court correctly interpreted the provision as applied to the parties. And therefore, we review that question de novo and owe no deference to the trial court regarding its interpretation of the provision. Isn't that correct?
I believe you're wrong. But there's, first of all, there's no prejudice. It's harmless error. There's a whole lot of things you can say about that one question that was asked because the court didn't rely upon it.
Is there any provision of the contract regarding the construction of the house that you contend Mr. McDaniel violated?
The actual construction? He violated it by unilaterally hiring Mr. Henderson when the court interpreted.
And I'm not asking about the court's interpretation. I'm mm-hmm. talking about which contract clauses regarding building the house did he violate? Where in the what provision of the agreement did he violate?
Well, there's not that many in the agreement, Your Honor, about how it was to be built. It was not a construction contract. It was a premarital contract.
I understand that, but what provision of the contract do you contend he violated?
17B.
Which says the parties will construct a house, and he constructed a house.
Well, it says that they mutually agree, and the court interpreted that to mean that the parties mutually agree that the portion of real estate shall be deeded into joint names. The intention of the parties is to build a home on the site. Parties, and then at the end, the parties further agree that this real estate shall be marital and shall be redeeded.
So he had an independent obligation to redeed the property he had purchased for $180,000 in her name. Did he do that?
Later on, yes, sir, he did. So the thing is, though, is that the trial court did not rely upon that one question that was asked, and it's not in his opinion letter, it's not in the order, so this court should really not take up that issue because it was not appropriately part of the trial court's decision-making rationale. And if you want to call it a harmless error, if you want to call it no prejudice, or no reliance, but the trial court did not use that one question as a basis for its decision. Its decision was based upon all the other evidence that it took, and so therefore it should not really properly be before this court for consideration. As to the next issue about notice, the court, as we said, based it upon his unauthorized unilateral act, and they said that, the court said, that because it was an unauthorized unilateral act on the part of the appellant, that therefore he had the first material breach and therefore was precluded.
Is there a contractual provision you can point me to that said he had to give her notice of hiring the building?
The judge interpreted to mean if you're doing something jointly.
I didn't ask that.
No, the agreement 17B is not a construction contract. It's a one paragraph. They're going to build this house together, and so the judge in interpreting it said that he had to do this on a joint basis, and that he didn't do it, and his unauthorized.
Counsel, may I interrupt you one more time, and I'm sorry to be obtuse about this, but if the language of the contract is clear, then whether it be the trial court or any other counsel or anyone else cannot add language to it. You're stuck with what you've got,
yes,
and that's what on the four corners of that document, and we all agree with what that says. And if there's been no finding of ambiguity, then you can't stretch it and add in to the contract things that should have, wish you, could have been in there that would have made it easier, and we wouldn't, if they were in there, we all wouldn't be here. But right. The contract is very clear. And what you're asking us to do is skip over the statement, if it's not ambiguous, then we can't add anything and we can't determine anything.
I agree with that, but the court, in its interpretation of that 17 video,
which we're not bound by.
No, sir, I didn't say you were. said that this was to be a joint decision of the parties to construct the house.
Could she have refuted, once she terminated, I believe, her cousin, who was mm-hmm. the first builder, could she have refused forever? Could, if he had sent her notice and said, I want this guy, no. I mean, that seems to be your position, that she would never have to agree, even though she had a contractual obligation to build the house.
He then could have filed suit against her for specific performance or breach of contract for her unreasonable refusal to proceed with the construction.
But doesn't that necessarily presuppose that there's a breach, which means she breached first?
No, sir, not at all. She stopped the construction by, as you say, her cousin, and he then unilaterally went out, knowing that had happened, never complaining about it, never objecting to it, and hires Mr. Henderson, and she knows nothing about that. And then they expend a couple $100,000 on that, and he sends her the bill, and then she objects to paying. So if she had, as you posit, you know, objected, and for months or years objected to any further construction, he had remedies under the contract that he could have enforced. But that's not what happened. What he did is that he just went out and hired somebody, didn't let her know, no emails, no texts, no phone calls, no personal conferences, and hired this gentleman, and then when it was basically over, she was aware of it and objected to it. So we don't think that in the context of what is in the record that he has appropriately set that forth, because the trial judge did not rely on that. He never mentioned it in his opinion letter. He never mentioned it in his final order. And so, therefore, you know, the court speaking through its orders, this court, I believe, has to review what the trial court did by its opinion letter, what he relied upon, and the order, which is what is to be appealed from, not just something ephemeral out in the sky that they want to pick up on later on. That was that's an improper use of jurisdiction of this court.
Counsel, you're out of time, but we have asked a number of questions,
yes,
so I'm going to give you a minute or so to go ahead and
the notice issue that we say that she didn't receive notice. I think we've set it out pretty clearly in our brief, so I won't belabor that as I usually would. And it was a question of unilateral action versus notice. I set out in the brief, on pages 6, 7, and 8 of my brief, the various things. Both parties agreed that it's to be a joint decision, but there's testimony in there that both of them agreed that it's to be jointly constructed. September, she stopped paying, and the agreement that he signed with Mr. Henderson, he's the only one that signed it. And he never called her, as I said, never called her, never texted her, never emailed her, never had anyone else do that. So she never received notice, and this, according to the trial court, was a breach of the agreement. It was the first breach, it was the first material breach that therefore precluded him from any further act enforcing the agreement. And if you look in the records, Your Honor, the appellant's counsel admitted that what he did was a breach, and that the court needed to determine the intent of the parties through the agreement. That was admitted by counsel for the appellant, and admitted also that it was to be constructed jointly. So these were positions that they took in the proceeding that is consistent with what we're saying. I think the quantum merit is too easy. It's
You don't need to speak to the quantum merit. Since you're running out of time, I don't want you to waste it on that. So we've given you a couple of minutes more, but if there's anything you want to wrap it up with, you need to do so very quickly.
Well, we would repeat our motion to dismiss, which we think is appropriate. We think if the court starts relaxing that rule for some reason, then the clear intent and words of that rule will be abrogated, and that people will not have to follow the rules of citing in their assignments of error where they preserved it, which they didn't do. Their position is, well, in their reply brief, well, it's in there. We cited it in the, you can find it in this page of the transcript, or this page of the appendix, or this page of the order, which is on page 618 of the appendix, I believe. But that's not what the rule says. The rule says that it has to be in the assignments of error, and they failed to do that.
We're very familiar with the rule, and we like the rule. Thank you.
I can imagine you did.
Thank you, counsel.
That's all I have. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. And I believe you have some rebuttal time left if you wish to use it.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The response to the procedural question, we have submitted a reply. We won't beat the dead horse, except simply say that we think that we honor the letter in spirit of 5820 and cited two in our assignments of error, the page pagination upon which the arguments. And again, this is not about the assignments of error is not so much about the oral testimony as opposed to the summation of all that evidence, which was a series of arguments having to do with the parole evidence, the admission of that, and whether there was a breach. And so they're rather comprehensive, sweeping assignments of error, but the nub is that we never believed, never contended, and disputed that my client had breached the contract. We said the contract was unambiguous. We said that you can't take all this evidence. Once the court started, and counsel and I disagree on this one point, counsel refers to one question. We believe the entire flow of evidence after the question about, well, what happened, everything that's in the record, or a good portion of what's in the record, is all about the interpretation of that contract. Who did what, when, whether they should or shouldn't have, whether the letter was sent, all the letters then were admitted into the record from February 2010 forward, from our first counsel on Mr. McDaniel's behalf, saying, hey, what are we doing about the house? Hey, what are we doing? You cut the electricity off, I'm working on it. All that stuff would not have been relevant, and evidence offered about everything that they, all the rocks they threw at Mr. McDaniel about how he went about the continued construction and the issues he was having, none of that stuff would have meant anything had the court not made the initial finding of ambiguity and then decided to take all that other additional evidence. The last point we will make, the court I know understands my position, or appears to understand my position, our position on as to the contract. Only as to the quantum merit issue, we just note this as a matter of law. We don't think, we found the case Richmond Company versus Richmond, 145 Virginia 266. It's a 1926 case, and I'm not sure the court's been laying awake reading 1926 Supreme Court cases. However, we tried to do a check on that. And the language, I don't think, has been changed. That quantum merit does not have to be pled if a court finds a violation of a contract, and therefore looking for an alternative remedy. Thank you all very much.
Any questions from counsel? Thank you, sir. We'll come down and greet counsel. I assume that both of you signed.